Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. We had a bit of a technical difficulty earlier, but we have a very special guest tonight, a wonderful, intriguing subject. We have Kathy Lynn Austin, one of America's foremost experts on arms trafficking. For over 20 years, Ms. Austin has carried out in-depth field investigations into illegal trade in weapons. She's the executive director of the Conflict Awareness Project. Kathy Austin will talk about her role in trafficking and bringing down Victor Bout, the notorious arms Russian arms dealer known as the Merchant of Death. Ronnie, we're in store for a great show. Take it away.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Kathy Lynn Austin.
Thank you both, Ron and Will. Great to be here.
Great. You're a busy woman. Catching up with you is hard to do. And, you know, I got this idea when I saw you on a CNN interview, and I was kind of startled, you know, to see you and to learn what your occupation was. So I guess a good way to start this interview is, what is a nice woman like you doing in a dirty business like arms trafficking?
Well, that's a very good question. I think my parents are asking every day of their lives. I've put a lot of gray hairs on their heads. I just got into this business 20 years ago, came right out of college, out of an internship in Washington, D.C., and I was sort of at the forefront in D.C. when the Iran-Contra story broke out and began to understand a lot about how covert operations were being carried out overseas, and Africa has always been a place where I've been interested, and so I just wanted to carry that same kind of investigative work into covert operations in Africa, so I started in 1989 in Angola.
Wow, 1989 Angola, and you've been at it ever since. So you're director and founder of the Conflict Awareness Project, and I noticed that your scope is quite broad. You have human rights in there as well, right?
That's right. Well, I started out as a human rights investigator. My first really sort of salvo in the world was when I had identified in 1994 right. during the Rwandan genocide the private arms traffickers that had sort of stepped into the vacuum of where governments used to operate right. in this sphere. So since 1994, and that's actually the same time that I began to see Victor Bout arrive on the scene. So he and I basically kind of started in the same places at the same time, about the same age.
Right, about 1994, right, when you were in Rwanda?
That's correct,
right,
in the Rwanda
that sort
genocide.
Of thing. Well, you know, arms trafficking, I saw that, you know, that movie with Nicolas Cage, you know, the Lord of War,
right.
which is supposedly based on him, and it's a very dangerous business. You know, and I'm wondering, you know, does being a woman in this type of business, very macho, very ruthless, very cutthroat, pose any challenges to you when you show up and they see who you are?
Well, I actually think that's what's sort of been one of my key assets is being a woman. Basically, a lot of these guys, as you just mentioned, they're macho. They do not believe that women are really a threat to their business.
Right.
And so they basically kind of take me into their confidence. And it's also kind of easy to saddle up to them, you know, in bars right. and in funky places over drinks, and they start talking about their exploits. So really, sometimes I feel like I'm just like this feminine fly on the right. wall where they're just kind of opening up and pouring out their hearts, and they don't really know what I'm going to do with that information and that I'm really going to go sort of after them.
That's right. Well, I, you know, I'm curious because I'm an investigative journalist, and you do investigations. So I'm sure we share a lot of things in common in terms of the way we try to get information from people who don't want to give it up. So what do you do when you're involved with an investigation? How do you go out? Do you field work? Do you do research like I would do? I'd go to the library, find everything I could find about a subject before I went to interview them and try to get a list of sources. How do you approach a subject?
Well, I mean, you know, often I start, like every investigator starts with certain hypotheses, but really for me, the key is what I'm going to find on the ground. And so I just kind of raise the money that I need to raise, or perhaps I'm like hired by another human rights organization, or sometimes I'm at the forefront of working for the UN, and I just go into the field and I just kind of basically start from scratch, and I start looking at, you know, logistics of war, logistics of conflict, how I feel that supplies are getting into a certain area. And once you start identifying the logistics and the pilots and the people who are delivering the goods, the arms, makes it, you know, then I start going after, you know, identify targets and start trying to get the real kind of evidentiary information I need to make a very strong case.
I'll tell you, it makes me shiver a little bit because it sounds very dangerous. Have you been in any situations where you wondered, well, am I going to get out of this?
Well, you know, it's always when you're in a war zone or conflict zone, there's just inherent danger, and I think one of the things that I'm most afraid of are the unexpected. It's the landmines or being caught in an ambush, and so I have been in those situations where, you know, I have had people holding my hand, you know, die right in front of me. Those have not been easy times, and also I think, you know, as an investigator, we rely as well on our translators, on our drivers, on our fixers. So they're at the forefront of danger because I get to leave the field when it's all said and done.
Right.
You know, they're on the front lines, and sometimes they take basically the rap for me. But basically, we're all coming from the same place. We're trying to target and bring home the evidence that will stop a lot of this kind of criminal activity and this warmongering activity. And, you know, just in the interest of international peace and security, we feel we're making a strong contribution, whatever the risk.
Right. Now, this criminal activity happens to be the biggest criminal activity in the world, right? Even bigger than drug trafficking.
Well, arms. Come on. You know, it's ubiquitous. Absolutely.
Right. And when we talk about arms trafficking, what kind of weapons are we talking about?
Well, mostly what I look at is small arms. So I'm looking at everything from, which can include surface-to-air missiles because they've kind of become a mainstay of some of the modern conflicts. But mostly I'm looking at AK-47s, rifles, grenades, landmines. Those kinds of weapons, which are portable, easy to smuggle in, and wreak a lot of damage. And so basically one of the things that I've been trying to do throughout the 90s and this decade, you know, is to say that small arms are the weapons of choice, and they're the real weapons of mass destruction in most of the conflicts we're seeing today.
Right. And where do these weapons come from?
Well, yeah, good question. I mean, it also depends on the conflict area, right? But, you know, if you take, for example, Victor Boot, what made him such a successful entrepreneur in the arms trafficking business was that he had easy access to former Warsaw Pact arms supplies. So at the end of the Cold War, you had weapons still being produced in the former Soviet Union, in places like Bulgaria, sort of throughout that area. And so he was able to get a steady source of supply. Mm-hmm. One thing that's very important to note today is that the Russian army, for example, is retiring its old AK-47. It has a whole new weapon, new brand that it's adopting. And so what you're going to see is you're going to see all those old stockpiles of AK-47 just flying around the world to different places. When we look at some of the conflicts going on right now, we see that a lot of weapons have leaked from Libya, for example, from former conflict areas. And so sometimes these weapons get circulated. But a lot of weapons are coming from China, from North Korea. One of the most fascinating things that I've investigated is that China wants to often hide its arms sales to places in Africa, and so they'll use North Korean markings, and North Korea turns around and does the same. So it does make it hard sometimes to really determine the country of origin of some of these weapons.
In researching our interview, I discovered that the U.S. military used Boots services, right? His plane.
Absolutely. 140 flights into Iraq. And they already knew his modus operandi. Yeah. They already knew that whenever he had the cover of some legitimate business, he would be trafficking weapons to the opposite side of the conflict or to the enemy. And that's exactly what he was doing in Iraq. So despite that fact, the U.S. government continued to use him in Iraq. And it was even in violation of a U.S. executive order. It was against U.S. law. And still the Pentagon felt that he could provide the kind of service they needed cheaper than other entities and used him.
How long did these services extend to?
You know, it's whenever there's kind of a national security operation, you know, governments will subcontract to these covert operators.
Especially in Iraq, right? There's a lot of privatization.
Absolutely. So, you know, so for a long enough period, and even after there had been a public outcry, you know, after we were writing about and exposing the very specific operations of Boot in Iraq, the U.S. Pentagon continued to use him.
Right. Did you know that our man, Victor Bout, has a website?
He does. I mean,
I looked at it. It looks like he did it himself. And it says Victor. They describe Victor Bout, among other things, as dynamic, spontaneous, and well-dressed person. So I'm wondering how he could be a well-dressed person behind bars.
Yeah. Well, he's. You know, it's tough for him right now. Actually, he's been in solitary confinement. But I will say, from the time he was in Thailand,
right.
Where if you look at the pictures from Thailand, he's,
right.
you know, a big, bulky, mafioso-looking
right.
guy. Right now, he's a little bit more suave. He's been on a vegetarian diet, so who knows? Maybe prison he's seen the light.
Of course, no vodka, right?
Right. Right.
Now, I've got a quick question for Kathy.
Go ahead, Willie.
Rather a broad one. You know, you've been quoted as saying that we live in a world where the international arms trade is less regulated than coffee. What is the international community doing about this menace, in particular the United States? Any comments on that, Kathy?
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the key problem, to think that there's more regulations to trade laptop computers or bananas across borders, and then here we have arms, the most, you know, sort of lethal commodity being traded, sometimes seemingly willy-nilly without any real regulations. This is exactly where I'm hoping my work will have some impact. Throughout the 90s, I just wanted to illuminate that unregulated arms trafficking was a problem. We've been able to illuminate that now, and we've begun, but only just begun, to criminalize some of that activity. So one of the things that I'm working with is a group of organizations in a control arms situation to try to work with governments for an arms trade treaty. And an arms trade treaty will be negotiated in July of 2012 under the UN auspices. And the point of that arms trade treaty is to try to, for the first time, bring some sanity to this whole unregulated international arms trade.
Right. On that. Now, that, you know, that's really interesting, and we'll conclude our interview with a little bit about your suggestions and how we could reduce the problem of that. But getting back to this fascinating character, Victor Bout, in publicizing the show, I was trying to look for a comparison, and so I used the analogy that he was the Pablo Escobar of arms trafficking. And, of course, Pablo was a very, very violent, very, very vicious individual responsible for thousands of deaths. Was Victor Bout like that, too?
Well, the most interesting thing about Victor Bout is when he appeared on the scene in Africa, for example, in the mid-1990s, he started gobbling up the smaller mom-and-pop sort of arms trading shops and really built this huge empire. And the reason why he was successful was because he had an incredible air fleet of old Soviet airplanes. Mm-hmm. And so he basically was the Federal Express, if you will, of arms trafficking, or the McDonald's of arms trafficking. He could just deliver to any client, anytime, anywhere. And part of that reason was because he kept planes that were not well-maintained, that were all illegally operating. Mm-hmm. He paid his pilots pittances, and those pilots in those planes often dropped from the sky. So he really was able to deliver something at a cut rate price, which is what made him so ubiquitous.
Right.
But the most important thing about Victor Boot was, you know, he started working for the Soviet Union. He was a former military intelligence officer, but he went on to start wars in order to make a profit. And that's the type of arms trading entrepreneur that we're dealing with today. Those who are facilitating, starting, keeping wars fueled solely for, not for geopolitical reasons, but solely to make a profit.
How are they able to do that? Describe a scenario of how they would keep or start a war.
Well, exactly. So Victor Boot, I mean, after he had had quite a bit of success in facilitating war in the Congo, and he did this so that he could trade and, you know, reap the sort of benefits of trade in diamonds and gold and other minerals there, he went on to Liberia. He made a pact with the Liberian president at the time, Charles Taylor, and said, look, let's just foment this war in Sierra Leone. And we'll be able to reap trade from diamonds. I'll give you all the guns you need. And basically, that's sort of why he came to the attention of international law enforcement, was because he was put on UN sanctions list for the role that he was playing in Liberia and Sierra Leone in fomenting war and sponsoring that war and in taking out the diamonds and basically reaping a lot of profits for the war crimes that were being committed in those areas.
Right. Well, he was called the Merchant of Death, and of course, the movie Lord of War is supposed to be based on his life. How accurate is that movie? I know some of our listeners are probably going to go rent that movie. would that give them a true appreciation for the big problem of arms trafficking?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a biopic of Victor Boot's life. So it's a composite of a number of different arms traffickers and how they operate and their mentality. And sort of, although I don't think there is as much redemption as you may find Nicolas Cage character having
right.
in the end, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
Victor Boot's redemption is only coming, you know, behind bars where he now faces 25 years to life imprisonment. But that type and style and machoism and adventurism and disregard for human life and disregard for, you know, the disruption in the countries where they're operating, I mean, that certainly is the type of character that, you know, designed right after Victor Boot.
So he was a very powerful character. He had the Russian system, I guess, protecting him. He knew how to facilitate wars. What brought down Victor Boot?
Well, I mean, I think this is a very controversial point because basically for years, a number of human rights investigators like myself and also working for the UN and also working for other sort of law enforcement types had wanted to basically bring in Victor Boot. I mean, he was a sponsor of terrorism. He was a sponsor of, like, all of these wars that our tax money was going into paying, you know, cleaning up. And basically, there was very little done about him because he was still seen as an asset. Nobody wanted to, you know, in national security operations, governments are fearful of if once they find an asset, you know, it's very hard right. for them to let go. But what finally happened was that I think the pressure was so great on the U.S., and then you had the drug enforcement agency, the DEA, saying, look, we can score some victories. We're trying to expand our turf throughout the world. You know, we're competing with other U.S. government agencies in the law enforcement world. And, you know, look, let's go after some of the very big fish and show that, you know, we have the capability of doing that. And it was the DEA that led a sting operation Mm-hmm. And that's how Victor Boot was nabbed. Now, for some of us who wanted him to face trial for real crimes, mm-hmm. So that we could begin to set precedents for how these crimes should be dealt with and to give the victims a voice, you know, there's a little bit of discomfort that it had to be done through a sting operation. But at right. the end of the day, it's very important that this maniacal character is taken
right.
out.
Right. Well, I'm sure Victor Boot knows who you are, right? Is he a vengeful type person? Would there be any possibility that he put a hit on you?
You know, well, look at his website, and he will attack people over and over again, but he's never going to attack me because I'm a woman. It's just, it's not in the Russian mentality to be seen as
Russian
having your enemy
right?
as a woman. Absolutely. It's, you know, so I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I've been threatened by his thugs before in the past,
right.
And my family has been threatened. And so it's, you know, there's no easy ride in this.
Right.
There's no free ride in this. But I still think at the end of the day, there is still some respect because all of my work has been based on very, you know, deep investigations where I bring in the hard paper evidentiary material. And, you know, I do believe that I have, you know, that I've garnered his respect in that sense.
Right. Have you looked at him eyeball to eyeball in the
well,
courtroom?
Well, first
or
day in
else?
Court. First day in court, you know, was the
what
first
was that
time.
Like?
Well, it was amazing because I had arrived at the courthouse early. I wanted to be the first in the courtroom. I was on that first day, and there was no seats in the courtroom because the judge was basically, it was the day that they were deciding on the jury pool. And the judge said, okay, well, wait a minute. We have 12 seats left, and they're all in the jury box. And I was allowed in with other journalists and sat in jury seat number one, and that's the first day I came face-to-face with Victor Boot, and so that was a very surreal moment for
right.
both of us.
Well, I could see that as a great scene in the forthcoming movie, and I understand that what I've been reading, Angelina Jolie's going to play you. Where is that now?
Well, you know, movies take a long time.
I know. I have one of my books optioned, so I know
exactly.
what you're talking about.
I hope I'm still around when the movie comes out. But no, it's exciting. You know what I liked a lot is that, you know, Angelina Jolie looked at the material and she says, gosh, she said, you know, I've been playing these types of characters for a long time in this sort of, you know, unofficial spy world and what have you, and you have authenticity and you represent a lot of the sort of human rights issues that, you know, when I'm off the movie screen, I am fully engaged with. And so I actually found it quite an honor that immediately, you know, she was just wanting to play this character. So she's very fond of the character.
Right.
So, you know, movie is still in development. We'll just it's moving forward, so it's all positive. But, you know, hopefully it won't take 10 years to
right.
make this movie.
Who do you want to play Victor Boot?
Oh, man, that's a very good question. okay, you put me on the spot on that one. You know.
Well, you have to have a Russian accent for one.
Exactly. Let me tell you, the key person in this movie is really the pilot that works for Victor Boot. He, you know, the movie is based on a true story, and it's based on this triangular relationship between myself and Victor
right.
Boot and the pilot, which helped me basically expose a lot of his activities,
right.
who put himself in quite a bit of danger. So the real question is who's going to play that pilot?
Hey, Kathy, I got a quick
well,
one.
Before
too,
we go, Willie, we're yep. going to have to move on here, unfortunately, with the technical difficulties.
Okay.
On that, then, Kathy, we got to get you back on. You know, later on, because you got a book coming out too.
I do,
right? and we'll definitely want to get you back on with that. You've got your website. I want to alert our listeners to the website www.conflictawareness.org. That's conflictawareness.org, and we really enjoyed this conversation, and we hope to have you back on where we could expand on it.
Well, let's keep the conversation going. There's
oh, yeah.
a lot
yeah.
I have to say, and it's just it's really great that people are interested in this very obscure sort of arms trafficking world that sometimes seems to happen over there
right.
in faraway places, but affects us all.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for having me on the
and
show.
And you're a great emailer. So
great Twitter. Follow me on Twitter.
Well, I'm going to follow you on Twitter. We'll follow each other, and we'll twit away.
Great.
Until we have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you both.
Okay,
thank you,
great.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with our second special guest, Louis Diaz.
You bet. Yeah. Actually, I'll just email...
Brandon D. Brandon D. Ask him and he shall receive. See the light in the night. Call him and he'll wave goodbye. Just
And now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. Well, we had a bit of a some difficulties, but we're back now. At this time, we'd like to bring you Lou Diaz, the toughest nails ex-DEA undercover agent and author of the runaway best-selling turn pager of a book titled Dancing with the Devil. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, my friend Louis Diaz.
What, do you want to get me my butt kicked by trying to saying all that stuff about me? There's a lot of other tough DEA guys out there too, you know.
You know what? They're gonna call our show Technical Difficulty.
I see. I got it. Don't worry about it. As long as you're on, forget about it.
Right. So you know you're on February. You're one of our first guests, and we really appreciate
it. I was honored. Thank you.
Right, and you did Dancing with the Devil. Great read. You know, I read the book and I loved it. And how is it doing?
Well, I tell you what, my agent says we're close to being a bestseller.
Close only counts in horseshoes, Lou.
And hand grenades.
And so what does that mean? I mean, close to being a bestseller.
Well, no, we are moving along. We've been selling quite a bit of books, and we got tremendous interest on many fronts. We've made many different appearances. Both on broadcasted on many different radio programs, including yours, and I've appeared on several TV segments, and we're moving along. Really, I'm very happy with our progress, and we even have some offers for a movie.
Oh, that's great! Well, you said you're on some big shows. What shows were you on?
Well, one was the New York Times show in New York, and another one was the Christina's show. She's the Latin Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, wow. Wow. That must have given your book a boost.
Well, I'll tell you what, she put it right out there. You know, between takes, we were talking, and she said to me that she wants to get behind it 100%, and she wants to get Andy Garcia to meet me. She said that they were family friends.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether or not that was off the air, but when it was telecast, it was on the air.
Right. Well, your book must be in Spanish, right? I mean, it's
not... No. Well, first of all, no, you know, first of all, listen, I'm an American, first of all. Then I'm from Brooklyn, that's second. And third of all, I'm a Spanish-American. But, you know, the story appeals to everybody, you know. But, however, right. Because of my Spanish ancestry, there's a lot of interest in it from the Latin world, including Spain. I mean,
right.
I have it with two major
it's coming down the pipe,
but
right.
You know, what frustrates me is that Simon and Schuster
right.
Have not done anything on their behalf to push this in the Spanish speaking market.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, welcome to the club. That is the way publishing goes. You think that these big publishers would have these big machines, right? These publicity.
I don't get it.
Right. And well, you know, Willie and I are trying to find this guest. We have a great guest coming. I won't mention the name, but we can't find the phone number for the publicist for this publishing house.
I can't believe it.
You know, you can't believe that. And it's almost like it's a secret cult. You know, getting access to their authors. And Willie's been going crazy there, right, Willie?
You bet. You know, it's just like pulling hen's teeth, man. But anyway, we'll get to the bottom of it sooner or later.
Okay. Right on that. Okay. But you're mentioning the movie bit. Of course, everybody wants to you know, have their book option. Have you reached that stage yet?
Not yet. There's no money on the table, but I'm telling you, there's some significant interest. But more importantly, I tell you what, Ron, I got to tell you something. The greatest satisfaction that I have is the wonderful, wonderful emails that I'm getting and the reviews that I'm getting on Amazon.com.
Right.
You know, it's really heartfelt because this is what I meant for when I wrote this book. You know, it was, you know, I'm not making a living on this. This was my life story. It was something that I needed to do, you know, for many different reasons. It was cathartic as well as purgative for me. I mean, I found myself in this book. I even answered some questions for myself that I've been fighting with my whole life, you know. And a lot of it had to do with my father. A lot of it had to do with myself and struggling for my own identity, in making something of myself. You know, it's an American story. I'm very proud of it.
Oh, it is. I read it, and those you know, those parts that dealt with your upbringing, with your father trying to get his approval, it was really heart-wrenching. And I think most readers or most listeners, many listeners can identify with it.
Right.
You know, having
that,
this relationship, very
right.
tough relationship,
right.
especially in an ethnic neighborhood, right? Because you came from Brooklyn.
Oh,
you know, very ethnic, and, you know, the ethnic fathers, you know, I grew up with them, you know, where none of these timeouts, right?
No, forget about that. None of this psychological bullshit. Like,
right,
oh,
right.
you know, you know why you shouldn't do this? You know why?
Right,
because
right.
get the hell out of here. You got whacked in the head, and you got
right.
caught a beating. That was it.
And you turned out pretty good, you know.
Absolutely.
Didn't rob any banks. And
matter of fact, we should get back to that. Are you kidding me? But now they lock you up. They lock you up even if you insult your kid. Can you believe that? Oh, my. Where are we going? We need to get back to brass tacks, Ron and Willie. We need to get back to what America was.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
Hard-working Joes. And real values,
responsibility for your actions, right?
This bullshit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, we called everybody everything that was in the book. You know,
right.
including the blacks, the Puerto Ricans, the Cubans, the Polacks, the Italians. Yeah, everybody
right.
caught it. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right. That's right.
I mean, what the hell is all this bullshit about anyway? You know?
Right. Hey,
but anyway, my book is a lot about all that.
Right. Well, we got to bring you back to the East End, right, Willie?
You bet. I thought you. Hey, yeah, you know, Lou, you talk just like the boys from the East End.
Right.
I'll tell you.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I think that has something to do with him. Boy, hey, Willie, you promised me a beer down there, you know that?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're welcome
right.
anytime, though.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Louis, so what else have you been doing? I mean, you're waiting around for this movie to hit, and, you know, we just got off the phone with a very nice lady, Kathy Lynn Austin, who's an arms traveling expert, and she's got a movie with Angelina Jolie in the pipeline.
Can you believe that? Unbelievable.
Right.
God
and,
bless
you know,
her.
That's right. But, you know, it's been in the works for at least 4 years.
There it is.
You know,
see that?
You know,
as you well know, it's not an easy thing. I mean, I've heard of these things. I mean, it's the. I mean, what was it? The Thornbirds with they did a TV pilot about 10, 15 years ago. I mean,
right.
that book was on the shelf for 20 years,
that's
I think.
Right.
Or something.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Well, I hope it don't take that long for mine. I'll tell you right now. You know, I'm getting up there, you know?
That's right. But what are you doing? I know you like to work out. And
well, I'll tell you why, Ron. I'm very excited about this. I'm one of the mentors and coaches, volunteer coaches for the All-American Heavyweight Program.
Oh,
it's
great.
It's run by Michael King of the King Brothers. And we have four super heavyweights who are going to compete in Colorado for a berth on the Olympic, the United States Olympic
right.
team, as well as Michael Hunter, who's competing
right.
for the heavyweight, which he's pretty sure to get
wow,
as far as representing us in England as a heavy American heavyweight. And I will be going down there February 29th through the 4th for the finals.
Right.
So
well,
hopefully we will have one of our boys on that team.
Right. Well, you know, the heavyweight division, as far as Americans are concerned, is pathetic. You know,
the last heavyweight gold medalist we had was...
I'm talking about the pros.
Oh, the pros?
Yeah, so I'm wondering if this is going to be a revitalization of
the
American heavyweight thing.
That's the idea that Michael King has. That's
right.
his idea. That's the whole reason behind this program, to revitalize the heavyweight program.
Right. Now, you mentioned we were talking about robberies there back a little while, and we didn't get a chance to cover Ronald Biggs, right?
No,
and
I don't think so.
Right. We didn't tell it. And let's talk briefly about that. Biggs was the guy that masterminded the great train robbery. In
That's
1963,
right.
It was one of the biggest robberies of all time. And this is really interesting because it was a train robbery, and you're with the DEA.
Right.
And so how do you get connected to the Biggs investigation?
Well, it's a series of, life is a series of coincidences and, you know, what avenue takes you where and what have you, know. But it happened as a result of hard work and good luck, you know.
Okay.
But we got this guy, delivering a kilo of cocaine,
right.
And the guy flipped, and the guy cooperated. His passport looked like a stamp collection. You know, this guy had been all over the world, and he was a major mule for the Colombians, but he was an Anglo, this guy, you know?
Right.
And he said, listen, I ain't giving up no Colombians. I'm not about to have a Colombian bow tie.
Right.
You know? He says, but I have these guys in England that have been dying to get me to transport heroin into the United States. So make a long story short, the guy flipped, and he put us in touch with a bunch of guys in England, and they sent us a sample of pure heroin. And then, make a long story short, my partner and I, we flew out there with our informant, and through working with Customs and Scotland Yard, I got to meet Ron Leslie, who was one of the original guys in the great London train robbery that was masterminded by Ronald Biggs.
Right.
Now, Ron Leslie was the guy who also helped him escape.
Right.
All right, so anyway, make a long story short, Ron Leslie became a big guy in England on the drug front, on counterfeiting and what have you, and I was introduced to him directly, and we negotiated for 4 kilos of cocaine, rather for 4 kilos of heroin, as a start for a steady stream of heroin into the United States, with the final deal being consummated for 40 kilos.
Wow. We'd love to go more in depth with the story, but because of the
problem
we had tonight, we're going to have to cut out short. But when I invited you on the show, we were talking about Biggs, and we were trying to figure out whether he's alive or dead. The final word, Lou, he's alive.
Oh, he's alive. Okay. Because I know they let him out of the joint, right?
Right. Yeah, he's out of the joint. He had a stroke in 2011. But as far as I could determine, I did a search on him. He's alive. And when we get you back on, again, we can discuss this fascinating investigation in depth. But we really enjoyed having you on again, Lou, and wish you good luck. And remember, this book is Dancing with the Devil. If you haven't got a copy of it, you should go out and get it, because it's a great read. It reflects Louis's personality. So what you see, what you get on the show, and that's the way the book is too. Right, Lou?
And if you don't, my friend Vinny Randazzo will give you a personal call.
Way to go, Lou. All the best there, buddy.
Okay, Louis.
Take care, guys.
Okay,
thank you. Show. You're doing great.
Okay, thank you again. We've enjoyed having you on.
Bye now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That's
great.
Yeah.
Willie?
Well, you know, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for March the 1st. Our guest will be Mr. Frank Collada, author of Collada, The Life of Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. Collada will take us behind the scenes of the deadly Chicago Mafia. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoy Crime Beat this evening, despite a few technical difficulties. The Artist First World Radio Network, here with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Hrib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Hrib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.